1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Should 5% appear too small? Be thankful I don't take it all. 'Cause I'm the tax man.
I forgot to celebrate Tax Day a few weeks ago, so we celebrate it with the great guitar work of George Harrison and John Lennon with the Beatles. I am Hank Jones. You are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio. Find us every day at blogtalkradio.com. It is Wednesday, May 3rd, 2023, or 2023, however you want to say it. First Wednesday of the month. Wow. Time's flying, isn't it? It happens as you get older, by the way. Anyway, as I said, we are here every day. 7 days a week. Mondays, Vito and Al, the Vito Esposito Show. Mamma Mia No Sharia. Tuesdays, Vito is taking it when he's taking it. Wednesdays, me, Hank Jones, with Hank Jones Poly Sports, where politics and sports collide. Thursdays, every once in a while, hankerings. I did not go last week. I was supposed to, but I ended up getting a paddle. So I don't mean getting paddled. I ended up having to cover some paddles on that day. I'm normally not a daytime paddler. I like it nighttime. It gets kind of hot here in Florida. Once in a while, they need it. So, and then Fridays, Vito is in right now, taking back our republic. Strong show of force. Conservative Casual Friday. Basically, yeah, we need it. Saturday nights, Minister Osama Dakduk and the Beautiful Christie, 10 p.m. to midnight, with Revealing the Truth About Islam. And then Sundays, Eric is in. Cross and Crescent Discussion, Real Interfaith Dialogue, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Meanwhile, at the Hank Jones Polysports Space Force Observation Outpost, the little Aussie has been fed. Hank's better half is overworking diligently in acoustic Hank land. And today's first internet laughy. It's just good. Hasbro introduces new Transition Me Elmo doll. God. There's more of that stuff in the news these days. It's just getting crazy. So, hey, several ways to interact with the show. You can, of course, listen online. Or you can even come in and log in with your own username. Click on the live button. Look for Global Patriot Radio, where you can come in and then interact in our chat room, as Indy Hawk and Duck Northwest Media are doing as we speak. Or you can call in 319-527-6706. That's what Hawkeye Mike, Sue from New Mexico, and my uncle-in-law are doing right now. You can listen in. You don't have to say anything. If you want to, you can. Hopefully, Hawkeye Mike's going to be doing that a little bit, hitting the one, so I know he's ready, so we can do our feature. Second part of our three-part feature on Beatles guitarists as part of our Great Guitarists Who Are No Longer Here series. Oh, and we've got our second Internet Laffy of the day. You're not going to believe this. John Fetterman filibustered the Senate for 7 hours, attempting to say hello to his Senate colleagues. This is what it sounded like, supposedly. That's pretty apropos, really. I mean, that's pretty much what Fetterman sounds like all the time, and that's what he hears. So, you know. Anyway, let's get to our old bits. Last Wednesday, we lost former Ohio State NFL and CFL defensive back Sonny Gordon, age 57, from ALS. He was president of a senior class at Middletown High School in Middletown, Ohio, which, incidentally, is also the high school alma mater of former Ohio Mr. Basketball and Indiana Hoosier star Butch Carter. Little trivia, Butch Carter was the first person in Ohio to be named Mr. Basketball as a player and win Coach of the Year. Anyway, Sonny Gordon with ALS, a.k.a. Lou Gehrig's disease, he worked with his family to raise money for research into the disease at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. It's also noted when he was inducted into one of several honorary groups. Rather than choose a former coach, he chose one of his high school science teachers. As I said, he was president of his senior class. He was a three-year starter at safety for Ohio State, 14 career interceptions, served as a captain his senior year. During his career, they went 3-1 in bowl games with a win in the Fiesta, Cotton, and Citrus Bowls and a loss to USC in the Rose Bowl. He was a sixth-round pick, 157th overall by the Tampa Bay Bucks in the 1987 NFL Draft. Rest in peace and prayers for the family of Sonny Gordon. Last Thursday, we lost former major leaguer and NBAer Dick Groat to complications from a stroke, age 92. He was on the World Series winning team for the 1960 Pittsburgh Pirates and the 1964 St. Louis Cardinals. We also lost a former mayor of Cincinnati, Ohio, as well as TV host Jerry Springer, pancreatic cancer at age 79. Obviously more famous for his TV show. It's arguable or debatable that he was the original tabloid or trash TV host. He was actually born in London in 1944 during World War II. His family had escaped from Prussia. We now know that as Poland during the Holocaust. His two grandmothers died in camps over there, as well as a great uncle. Family that moved to New York in 1949. Got his bachelor's degree from Tulane, law degree from Northwestern. Worked on the presidential campaign of Robert F. Kennedy in 1968. Served on the Cincinnati City Council for 7.5 years, including a year as mayor. Actually won local Emmy Awards for both news and sportscasting before his eventual career as a tabloid / trash TV host. That show, man, that show, I gotta admit, I'd watch it sometimes. So here's the sad part. A former employee of mine years ago actually was on that show. It was a female playing the part of a female. This is back before all that other stuff. I don't think it was a pregnancy thing. I think it was just she and seven other girls were fighting over some loser. That was a thing I never understood. It would be like they'd bring out this guy that's like, this guy's got two people. No, wait a second. He's got three people fighting over him? Are we kidding? And believe me, the girls that would occasionally be fought over weren't no big bargains either. But anyway, seemed like a nice guy, Jerry Springer. Friday, we lost another member of the Bachman family with the death of former Brave Belt and Bachman Turner Overdrive guitarist Tim Bachman, cancer, age 71. Just a little over 3 months after his brother Rob died. Brother Rob was the drummer in that group. Rob was just 69. Tim left BTO in 1974 to spend more time with his family and work in concert promotion. He rejoined the group for a reunion album and tour. They opened for Van Halen on that group's Monster tour for the 1984 album. Saturday, we lost another former World Series champion from the Cardinals, former third baseman and outfielder Mike Shannon. Now, he'd had COVID back in 2020, was actually placed in a medically induced coma for like 15 days. Apparently, he suffered from long COVID after that, although they didn't actually say what the actual cause was. He was 83. He played on the winning teams for the Cardinals in both 64 and 67, played for the Cards from 62 to 70, went into the restaurant business, as well as working radio broadcasts for the Cardinals from, 1972 to 2021. So, well, this one's kind of hits close to home. Sunday, we lost former PGA golfer Lance Tenbrook at age 67. He grew up in the Chicago area where I grew up. I remember reading about him when I was younger. Good golfer. I believe he was an Illinois state champion. After he completed his PGA career, he then served as a caddy on the tour. Incredibly, he later caddied and played in the same tournament on several occasions. He would be an alternate and be pressed into service as a player. His lone tour championship win came at the 1991 Magnolia State Classic, now known as the Sanderson Farms. Went by several other names, including the Deposit Guarantee Classic. Remember, it was played as one of those alternate PGA events. It was staged on the same weekend as the Masters for guys that didn't get into the Masters. We also lost former Olympic long jumper Ralph Boston. Stroke complications. He was just 83. He was a three-time Olympian for the U.S. He won gold in 1960 in Rome. He won silver in 1964 at Tokyo, and then he won bronze in 1968 at Mexico City. He was the first long jumper to jump 27 feet. It improved his world record, actually, to 27.4 and 3/4 in 1965. And then he became sort of an unofficial mentor to Bob Beamon, if that name rings a bell. Yeah, he sat and watched as Bob Beamon destroyed the world record in Mexico City with an almost unfathomable jump of 29.2.5 at altitude, but still. That was in the Olympic final. He later covered field events as part of CBS Sports Spectacular's track and field coverage. He was inducted into the USA Track and Field Hall of Fame in 74, the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame in 1985. A couple other losses in the track world. Monday, we lost former U.S. Olympic 400-meter hurdler Calvin Davis. He also ran on the 400-meter or 4x400 relay team. Just 51, no cause given. He normally specialized in the flat 400, but then he found greater success in the hurdles. Actually won Olympic bronze in Atlanta in 1996, and he was part of the U.S. gold-winning 4x400 relay at the World Indoor Championships in 1995. This next one, man, I'm not even sure how you – this one's tough. We'll start it out here. Yeah, Monday we lost Canadian legend, singer-songwriter Gordon Lightfoot, natural causes, age of 84. In addition to hits like If You Could Read My Mind, Carefree Highway, Beautiful, and Rainy Day People, and of course Sundown, he also penned and sang this classic tribute to the 29 members of the ship SS Edmund Fitzgerald, which was toting iron ore or taconite pellets. Went down in Lake Superior. He was a featured performer at the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary. Regarded as a rare talent and national treasure by the like of Bob Dylan and the band's Robbie Robertson. In addition, his songs were performed and are recorded by some pretty legendary types. Elvis, Barbara Streisand, Johnny Cash, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Jim Croce, Harry Belafonte, and Olivia Newton-John. Oh, and he settled out of court with the guy who claimed authorship of the song The Greatest Love of All, you know, the one by Whitney Houston and George Benson also did a version. It's part of that song's transitional section, which often copies the song If You Can Read My Mind. But it was this song, Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, that he considered to be his finest. He was inspired, of course, by the events of November 10th, 1975, when the SS Edmund Fitzgerald sank during a brutal November storm in Lake Superior. He felt compelled to write about the event after he read a Newsweek article that was published after it happened. The article was titled The Cruelest Month. The song reached number one in Canada, reached number one in the U.S. on Cashbox, and spent 2 weeks at number two on Billboard behind Rod Stewart's Tonight Tonight. It was his second most successful single behind Sundown. And in my opinion, raised one of the greatest songs ever. He worried about possible historical inaccuracies, believe it or not, especially since the records hadn't been found at the time that he wrote the song. He freely admitted taking historical and artistic license, but producer Lenny Warnker encouraged him to play it to his artistic strengths. Just tell the story. He did change some lyrics later. After a parishioner of the Mariners Church of Detroit, which he called Maritime Sailors Cathedral, informed her that the church wasn't really musty at all. He changed the lyrics for the re-recording of the 1988 Gord Gold compilation release and for live performances. He said he changed it from In a Musty Old Hall to In a Rustic Old Hall. He did not change the copyrighted lyrics. He just preferred to utilize different lyrics as performance and locations dictated. Let's listen to this a bit. This is a great song. Guy had a vocal style, didn't he?
Does anyone know where the love of God goes with the words of the ships to ours? The searchers all say they have made whitefish bay if they put 50 more miles behind us.
Actually, that was one of these.
They might have split up or they might have capsized. They may have drove deep and took water.
This part's done.
All that remains is the faces and the names.
The wise and the sons and the daughter.
Great song, isn't it? It really is. I hate to stop it, but kind of got it. So, today, USA Track and Field released the news that former U.S. Olympics women's sprinter Tori Bowie passed away at her home in Florida, just 32. 32. No other details have been released. She began her career as a long jumper, won NCAA championships in the event in 2011, both indoor and outdoor, at Southern Miss. She actually migrated to the 100 and 200, where she had excelled in high school. She won silver and bronze, respectively, in those events at the 2016 Rio Olympics, silver in the 100, bronze in the 200. She also won gold as part of the U.S. 4x100 relay. She followed that up with golds in the 100 and the 4x100 in the 2017 World Championships. And then she actually won bronze in the 100 at the World Championships in Beijing in 2015. All. Don't forget my friends at Alliance Communications, Central Florida's 24-hour call center and answering service. Messaging services for your medical clinic, hospital clinic, service company. If you're one of those offices that's not going to return to a traditional workplace after COVID, they could be your front line. They also work with remote staff so that disasters are no longer a reason for a call center to close down. If you like remote work or you need their services, give them a call, 800-555-3738, or visit them on the web, alliancecommunications.com. Okay, let's get to the news. According to Yahoo News, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin is, quote, playing with fire. That's a quote from Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski. He's playing with fire with regard to his efforts to repeal the Inflation Reduction Act, a bill that he was widely criticized for supporting last year. Yeah, there's probably a catch. Yahoo News pretty much tells you the catch. Basically, okay, so he's losing patience, it says, with his fellow Democrats over their signature climate law. The feeling is mutual. It says he spent weeks escalating attacks on the Inflation Reduction Act. Last week, he threatened to join Republicans in voting to repeal it, as the GOP is demanding in its legislation for raising the nation's debt limit. Here's the thing. Want to know why? Well, of course we know why. He now has an opponent. Very popular West Virginia Governor Jim Justice. Everybody always talks about Manchin being a big boss coal guy. So is Jim Justice. And Jim Justice has been a very popular governor in West Virginia. So yeah, not too shocking, huh? Joe Manchin suddenly wants to repeal the very bill he put over the top. The duplicity is staggering, is it not? I don't care which side of the aisle. It's on both sides of the aisle, but my God, this guy sold us out completely. Now he suddenly has misgivings? Yeah. Unbelievable, isn't it? NFL draft was last week, Thursday through Saturday. As usual, there were several surprises. A projected first rounder and presumably the third quarterback to be drafted, Kentucky's Will Levis, was not selected in the first round. And despite predictions otherwise, guess what? The Iowa Hawkeyes had two former players selected in the first round, with defensive end edge rusher Lucas Van Ness went to the Green Bay Packers with a 13th pick, and inside linebacker Jack Campbell going to the Detroit Lions at 18th. One NFL writer loves the Van Ness pick, but not the Campbell pick. In fact, this guy gave the Lions a draft grade of F, which, by the way, is the same grade I give his analysis of Jack Campbell. Here's what this moron wrote for Hawkeye fans that might be listening in, because this guy's a true moron. By the way, he gave the Chicago Bears an A grade. Like that's ever going to happen. Here's his least favorite pick. So first, let me tell you what he said about Lucas Van Ness. That's his favorite pick for the Packers. Says he's a bit raw, but he has the athletic profile of many successful edge rushers. He's explosive and managed to run the 3-cone drill in 7 seconds, despite weighing 270 pounds. He played all over Iowa's defensive line, and that experience will help him get started in the NFL. He's one of those rare 270-pound defensive linemen that has the strength to play against interior offensive linemen. He has the athleticism to stand up on the edge, too, which is where he'll spend a good chunk of his time with the Packers. Accurate assessment. Here's what he said about Jack Campbell. The positional value is one thing, but the bigger issue is taking Jack Campbell in the first round. He just wasn't projected to go anywhere near this. Could have had a full round later than where he was selected. Campbell is a quality linebacker when he's coming downhill in the box, but his ability to be an impact player in coverage and in space down the field is a major question mark moving forward. I know Hawkeye Mike and Indy Hawk got to be laughing at that. That's not the profile of a first round linebacker. Those types of players have to be weapons in the passing game to be selected, and Campbell isn't that god. This is that guy. Really odd selection at the 18th pick, even stranger than Jahmyr Gibbs at 12th. Here's what he said. Even taking Sam Laporta, Iowa tight end, with the 34th overall pick over Michael Mayer was a head-scratcher. If this guy's going to be an NFL writer, he ought to at least know what the hell he's talking about. He could start by actually watching Jack Campbell play a game. Just one. Of football. Watch him actually play football. That's pretty much all it would take. Yes, I was pleasantly surprised to see Jack go in the first round. He sure earned it. He definitely earned it. But the knocks from this guy, Jack Campbell's ability to be an impact player, quote, in space and downfield, being a question mark, is pure idiocy. Jack Campbell ran 4.65 at the combine. Elbert said that he made more money at the combine than just about any player, him and Sam Laporta. There's a reason he won the Butkus Award as the nation's best college linebacker. One of the reasons, by the way, his ability in coverage. I mean, did this guy not watch any games last fall? Obviously, he did not. Or if he did, he was too busy criticizing Brian Ferentz of the offense. I say that because his read on Jack Campbell is woefully unobservant. But to prove my point, guy offers up this gem about the Dallas Cowboys and their pick of Deuce Vaughn, running back out of Kansas State, with the 212th pick, by the way. Yeah, 212th pick. So here's what this guy says. It's his favorite pick, by the way. He says this is absolutely for sentimental reasons, but the Deuce Vaughn pick was the highlight of the entire draft. Whether or not Vaughn turns into something with the Cowboys doesn't even really matter here. There was no better moment than seeing longtime Cowboys scout Chris Vaughn being able to draft his son this weekend. It's an incredibly rare moment that even had Jerry Jones overcome with what was happening around him. Great moment, and hopefully Deuce gets to go to work with his father for more years to come. That's what this guy actually said about his favorite pick for the Dallas Cowboys. The 212th overall pick. And he counts that as the pick of the draft. As he says, absolutely for sentimental reasons. Yeah, you know what? If I'm drafting guys and paying them, say, $1 million. And more to the point, my scouting these guys, I want them basing it on something a little more than quote-unquote, sentimental reasons. But again, his assessment of Jack Campbell is just pure idiocy. Literally, pure idiocy. I don't even want to see what he said about Riley Moss. Mainly because I think he, you know, he just, well, no, let's just leave this guy. He's just an idiot. Speaking of pro and college football, to the transfer portal we go. Austin Smith is a former player at Colorado. As many know, Coach Prime, Deion Sanders, Prime Time, was named coach there after last season. One of his first acts as Colorado coach was to tell guys to transfer. Austin Smith, tight end, says he has a soft spot for Colorado, but he decided to leave for Memphis. He has 3 seasons of eligibility. But here's what he said. He said basically he wants a fair chance to compete. He said, you know, he went through spring practices. That Sanders told players he and others associated with the program did not consider salvageable to hop in the transfer portal. He said, we were excited when he came in. We were happy. Then he comes in, the mood kind of changes. Now, Smith says, I kind of like him. He does grow on you. Yeah, he must grow on him to the point that he left. Yeah, 41 former Colorado players entered the transfer portal. There aren't but 85 scholarship players on a roster. Now, I have no idea where he plans to replenish that, Coach Prime, but he says they, quote, have people coming. He also expressed disgust that only one player was selected in the draft from a historically black college university. Then again, he had all the best ones at Jackson State, Colorado. So, like, shouldn't he be happy? Who knows? Sunday was the last day for undergraduate players to declare portal entry. Two stand out from Michigan State. Both of them were starters. First, wide receiver Keon Coleman. He was their leader last season with 58 catches, 800 receiving yards, 7 touchdowns. He has multiple years of eligibility left. He's 6'4". He'll get offers. And then starting quarterback Peyton Thorne started the last two seasons, produced almost 6,500 passing yards, 49 TDs, 24 interceptions. Evidently, he was in a battle during spring practice with Noah Kim, a redshirt junior who had transferred year before from Virginia. Now, Peyton Thorne leaves as a graduate transfer. He has immediate eligibility. He may have 2 years, in fact. That has been made clear. Evidently, head coach Mel Tucker is happy with his overblown contract. Doesn't worry too much about quarterback, evidently. Other late entries, Purdue quarterback Brady Allen. He was Aiden O'Connell's backup. Nebraska quarterback Casey Thompson. He was the starter last year when he was healthy. Apparently, according to Nebraska fans, Georgia Tech transfer Jeff Sims, who went 2-3 as the starter last year, 30 touchdowns against 23 interceptions. Apparently, he's the answer. Despite missing the last 5 games of 2022, running for just 3 yards a carry, as a dual-threat quarterback. Yeah, exactly. Meanwhile, former Iowa quarterback, backup quarterback Carson May, he was passed over by Joey Labus for the last season's bowl game start. He entered the portal. He announced he's received an offer from Wyoming. Good for Carson May. College football playoff released a schedule for the new 12-team playoff for the 2024 and 25 seasons. It's set to begin with the 2024 season. Early games will be at campus sites, and then quarterfinals and semifinals will be played as and at bowl sites. Yeah, kind of interesting. So first-round games would be at campus sites. Friday, December 20th would be one game, and Saturday, December 21st would have 3 games. Quarterfinals would be Tuesday, December 31st at the Fiesta Bowl. And then Wednesday, there would be 3 games, January 1st, 2025, the Peach Bowl, the Rose Bowl, and the Sugar Bowl. Semifinals would be Thursday, January 9th at the Orange Bowl and January 10th at the Cotton Bowl. And then the championship would be Monday, January 20th, 2025 in Atlanta. Interesting. Next season, it would be first round at campuses. And then quarterfinals would be at the Cotton Bowl, Orange Bowl, Rose Bowl, and Sugar Bowl. Semifinals at the Fiesta and Peach. Kind of neat. So this season will be the last which we see a 4-team CFP format. A Delaware County, Indiana councilman is fighting back against outcry and calls for his resignation after he came out as a Native American lesbian. Yeah, Ryan Webb, who still uses his given name along with he, him as pronouns, announced he now identifies as a Native American as well as a lesbian since he is still married to his female wife. The outcry and calls for resignation, of course, are coming from Big Left. Webb says he's holding up a mirror to the political left, but that he does have Cherokee blood on both his mother and father's side. He posted on social media, he's honored to shatter this glass ceiling, that he will be a, quote, vocal partner for the LGBTQIAPC++ community. He appeared on Fox News Channel, interview with Jesse Waters. Here's a little bit more of the story. It's kind of interesting because, really, the guy is basically saying, y'all are kooks. That's what he's saying. Y'all are crazy. You're nutbags. He's very proud to highlight his Native American ancestors. When asked about Elizabeth Warren, he said, I don't know her history, but I think it's pretty consistent in that I have Cherokee on both sides. So he says he thinks that's enough to identify, self-identify as a woman of color. Waters noted when somebody comes out as an identity different from their medically determined identity, they are celebrated. And when anyone questions it, you are labeled transphobic or racist. Waters added that the left can't even find what a woman is anyway, including Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who could not do it, and Education Secretary Miguel Cardona. He said, asked about how people are reacting. He said, some people have been really upset. You know, they've been big mad about it. And, you know, we had a group of individuals show up at our council meeting to express their fake outrage. That is good. That is good. I really do, because it's just, as he says, he's holding up a mirror to the political left. Now, while that may be tongue-in-cheek, not to mention bizarre, this next story from ESPN is decidedly not tongue-in-cheek, and it's actually more pathetic than it is bizarre. It's about a transgender cyclist who recently won a race in New Mexico. I won't insult you by mentioning it's a bio male and that he won the women's division. I'll let the headline and story do that. Let me get to it. UCI, the world governing body of cycling, defends transgender policy after Austin Killip's victory. Policy after Killip fueled the debate by winning the Tour of the Gila in New Mexico on Sunday. Killip is 27, won the fifth and final stage to become the first transgender cyclist to triumph in an official UCI stage race. UCI still allows transgender riders to compete in women's races, prompting criticism from the likes of American former Olympian Inga Thompson, who said it's basically killing off women's cycling. She referred to a Twitter survey last year by a leading riders union that showed over 90% professional women cyclists opposed racing against TG athletes, but said their voices aren't being heard. Says the UCI acknowledges that transgender athletes may wish to compete in accordance with their gender identity. UCI rules are based on the latest scientific knowledge and a manner that UCI continues to follow the evolution of scientific findings and may change its rules in the future as scientific knowledge evolves. What? What the hell are they talking about? As scientific knowledge evolves. Austin Killips said she had been subject to a week of nonsense. I love my peers and competitors, and I'm grateful for every opportunity I get to learn and grow as a person and athlete, Thomas-like. Looks like, you know, well, a guy dressed as a girl. I'm not even sure where to go with this. I'm really not. So that's why, of course, in times like these, I default to the wisdom of the Simpsons. In this case, that of Otto, the school bus driver, who, when taking his driver's test with one of Marge's sisters, offered up this.
Any questions?
Yeah, one. Have you always been a chick? I mean, I don't want to offend you, but you were born a man, weren't you? You can tell me. I'm open-minded.
Oh. Yeah, when you're really struggling for wisdom, absolutely, default to the Simpsons. We should all do that. Back to bizarre. Boxer Floyd Mayweather, more or less retired, is returning to the ring for the second exhibition of five, that he will be doing five exhibitions in five countries. So who's the lucky guy? I mean, I'm going to presume it's a guy. I don't think even Floyd Mayweather would claim to be woke enough to get in the ring with an actual female. I can't speculate on him getting in the ring with a guy dressed as a female. But in this particular case, the opponent, if you will, has what some might call nefarious ties, as in the mob, as in he's going to be fighting John Gotti III, son of John Gotti Jr., grandson of the late Gambino family boss John Gotti, a.k.a. the Teflon Don, a.k.a. the Dapper Don. Exhibition will take place June 11th at FLA Live Arena in Sunrise, Florida. June 11th, that's one of my niece's birthdays. The 30-year-old Gotti III is no stranger to combat sports. He has a 5-1 MMA record, 2-0 as a boxer. And what might be the only thing not fake about this gig is Gotti III's camp released a promo statement from the fighter. It says, and I quote, "It's kill or be killed." Yeah. When it comes to boxing, yeah, get your talking points and your promo material straight out of the Murder Incorporated handbook. So next thing, I know it's just sports, but this is from the You Can't Make This Stuff Up files. Here's the title: Ultramarathoner Disqualified for Accepting Car Ride During Race. Yep. Dr. Joasia Zichevsky, an ultramarathoner from Scotland, was disqualified from the Manchester to Liverpool Ultra in England for hitching a ride in a friend's car during the 50-mile race. She finished third in the April 7th run, but forfeited her place to a fellow Brit, Mel Sykes, the original fourth-place finisher. Tuesday report from Angie Brown of BBC Scotland stated that Zichevsky, quote, is understood to have been tracked on GPX mapping data covering a mile of the race in just a minute and 40 seconds. He was apologetic, blaming sickness and jet lag after landing in England from Australia the previous evening. It wasn't malicious. It was miscommunication. I would never purposefully cheat, and this was not a target race, but I don't want to make excuses. How do you unintentionally accept a car ride during a road race of any distance? On the other hand, 1 mile in a minute and 40 seconds means either she rode in a golf cart or maybe she just plowed through a bunch of fellow racers. I mean, unless my math is wrong, unless my math sucks, and don't ignore that possibility, the vehicle is going around 36 miles an hour. I mean, if you're going to cheat, you know, go big. And for God's sake, I mean, sickness and jet lag, why the hell did she even enter the race? Why? Why? Now the economic front, two stories. First Republic Bank was finally seized by the feds, allowing J.P. Morgan Chase to step in and take over. So much for Jamie Dimon's earlier misgivings about having to step in when the feds ask you to step in and take over a failed bank. But the question really is, what determined that the institution was quote-unquote failed? If the feds and other banks looked into things, why didn't First Republic get more money? It's not like government printers are running out of ink. It's not like government and Congress haven't thrown a few trillion here or there. I mean, hell, just stop sending money to Ukraine and shore up our own financial institutions instead. I think there's more to it. I fear there's more to it. When we find out, it will obviously be too late to do anything for First Republic and their shareholders, who will probably be left with nothing. Depositors will be taken care of. Shareholders, probably not. Depositors will probably even get beyond the $250,000 statutory limit from FDIC. And what about those banks that threw those deposits First Republic's way, uninsured deposits? Chase steps in. A bunch of banks. When did I report on that? 2 weeks ago? 3 weeks ago? Already, First Republic is, quote-unquote, failed institution. That's not right there. I mean, if I'm one of those banks, especially a shareholder, yeah, I'm going to make some friggin' noise. Something's not right. I'm telling you, something's not right. By the way, another economic story. In the world of cars, there are now only three cars, new car offerings, available for less than $20,000. Only three. Would you like to know what they are? The Kia Rio 5. 875, hatchback at 18515, four-cylinder, 120 horsepower engine, highway rating of 41 miles a gallon. The Nissan Versa, starting at $16,925, 122 horsepower four-cylinder engine, five-speed manual transmission, and a five-star crash test rating. Automatic starts at $18,595, 40 miles per gallon highway rating. A fully loaded version with adaptive cruise control, heated seats, and a wireless charging pad tops out at $20,215. And the Mitsubishi Mirage and Mirage G4 starts at $17,340. And the Mirage G4 sedan is just $1,000 more. It's a three-cylinder engine, just 76 horsepower, and the most efficient non-hybrid vehicle, with hatchback getting an EPA combined rating of 39 miles per gallon. Jesus, just get a golf cart. Finally, before we go to break, this Saturday is the 149th running of the Kentucky Derby from Churchill Downs in Louisville. 20 horses entered, three alternates. Last month's owners or trainer or both withdrew Blazing Sevens, which allowed for the entry of Jace Road, and then Wild on Ice was euthanized last Thursday after suffering a left hind leg injury during a pre-race workout. Hit Show position at 30-1. Forte, trained by Todd Pletcher and ridden by Ron Ortiz Jr., is an early favorite at 3-1. Forte will run from the 15th hole. From the 5 spot is Tap It Trice, going off at 5-1. While just inside Forte from at 14th is Angel of Empire at 8-1. Trainer Brad Cox has 4 horses in the race. Todd Pletcher has 3. Post time, 6:57. It is the 1.25 mile first leg of the Triple Crown. Meanwhile, the day before, 5:51 Eastern time, p.m., the first leg of the Philly Triple Crown, the Kentucky Oaks, will go off. Going to go to break. When we come back, Hawkeye Mike is going to join me, and we are going to continue with part two of our great guitarists who are no longer here. In the meantime, enjoy a little Beatles music. back. We resume our Great Guitarists Who Are No Longer Here series. Remember, January was Jeff Beck. February was Tommy Bowen. March was Terry Kath. And this month it's George Harrison and John Lennon of the Beatles, both unfortunately no longer with us. Bring in Hawkeye Mike. Mike, how you doing?
Doing great, Hank. How's it going?
Oh, not bad. First, tell me a little bit. You know, you sent this stuff to me this morning about the drone attempts, it looks like, on Vladimir Putin. Anything more that you've heard on it? Or
no, I'm starting to think that it might have been a setup. You know what I mean? As far as something staged by the Russians even. I don't know if you saw any of the video they were showing on Fox, some of the other news channels about what happened. But it just and Ukraine's denying it, and I kind of smell a rotten egg here. Like it was the Russians it was a setup to try to make it look like this was an attack, so they could use it as a way to escalate. Although they don't really need an excuse, they're going to do what they want. But it could be try to justify doing. The thing that makes you nervous, of course, is would they try to use nuclear weapons? They say, well, this attack on attempt to kill Putin, you know, was beyond the pale, and now we're going to, you know, take the gloves off or something. I don't know. We'll have to see what happens. But if it was, let me put it this way, if it was a true attempt to attack the Kremlin and kill Putin, it seemed pretty lame.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Totally. I mean, so tell us also about the subs that we have out. We have 14 subs.
Yeah. Well, there's you can see these stories they had a little story I saw the other day on YouTube about America's submarine force, kind of the ace in the hole the U.S. has. We have 14 of these giant supersonic ballistic nuclear missile subs, SSBNs.
Right.
And each submarine has 20 D5 missiles, a complement of 20 D5 missiles. Each D5 missile capable of carrying 8 independently targetable nuclear missiles. So that would be a total of 160 nuclear missiles.
Times 14.
That each sub, you know, intercontinental ballistic, by the way.
Yeah.
Missile that each submarine can fire, and it's unmatched. There's no country that has that kind of the Russians and I don't know if the Chinese have any, but the Russians may have a few, but that could do damage, but they don't have the number or the range these things have, and I think they have a range of 12,000 kilometers or something like that, it would not be wise to start a nuclear war with the United States. These subs are virtually invulnerable. If you ever saw the movie, they touched on it a little bit in The Hunt for Red October, but if you recall the movie Crimson Tide, that was one of those missiles. I mean,
okay.
Submarines that movie was about. They were, if you remember, they lost contact, and there was a debate. With Gene Hackman playing the captain, wanting to launch, and Denzel Washington, the XO, not wanting to launch, and you know the intrigue that went behind that and all that.
Right.
Each one sub. Let's just put it this way: one of these subs could basically wipe any nation off the earth, the earth with their complement of nuclear weapons. But it's just an overwhelming sort of ace in the hole. As far as nuclear deterrence goes, and they're virtually invulnerable.
Yeah. So the only question is where Biden has them, whether or not Biden has them aimed at us. That's my fear. I mean,
story that I saw on YouTube was that they were sending one of these to South Korean waters. I guess as South Korea is nervous about North Korea.
Sure.
And so they're going to do that. And actually, I pointed this out. My brother had a good point. He goes, we shouldn't be hearing where any of these things are.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously this is not an official news release from the Pentagon or something.
Right, right.
But there's 14 other ones. Probably at any given time, 6 or 7 of them are out somewhere in the Pacific or the Atlantic. But the Russians most importantly, the Russians and the Chinese know about them and know what they're capable of doing. So when you hear a lot of bluster from them about, you know, like Putin, you know, we'll launch a nuclear war in Ukraine and wipe everybody off the face of the earth, they're forgetting about what could happen to them if they do something like that.
Exactly. Exactly. So let's get back to our tribute to George Harrison and John Lennon. So last week we basically covered every, you know, stuff up to Revolver. And this week, of course, we're going post-Revolver through the end of their reign as a group. And, you know, post-Revolver, they stopped touring. They were doing a lot more in terms of elaborate production in the studio, as evidenced by the albums that they put out. I mean, Sgt. Pepper, what did I miss? Magical Mystery Tour, Submarine soundtrack, the White Album, Abbey Road, Let It Be. I don't count that 1988 thing that they got put out with Free as a Bird or whatever. I mean, that's great. It's their stuff, but I don't count it. You know, that's just me. That's how I'm a stickler for that kind of stuff, but whatever. So, but let's get into, we've got some longer songs this week you know, the increased production probably warrants that, but your first choice is not a shock. It's on the White Album, also called The Beatles. It's more commonly known as the White Album. Tell us quickly what you chose and why.
Okay, I think you're referring to Revolution. And the main reason I chose this is the guitar riff that is just great right at the beginning of the song.
Yeah.
And then throughout, it's a real rock and roll song, great guitar throughout.
Yep. And who's, you know, I know on the White Album, Clapton plays. He's not playing on this, I assume.
No, and also a quick distinction. And I think on the White Album, they've got like a slowed down version of the song. I could be wrong about that. There's also something called Revolution Number 9, which is kind of a ridiculous screaming and yelling.
Revolution,
I think,
one.
Yoko Ono's first contribution.
Yeah, it's commonly Revolution
single,
1 is the one we're talking about.
Yeah, the single that came out as the flip side to Hey Jude
is
the one that everybody usually hears, and it's the one that's got the real rock and roll version.
Okay. Let's play it. Revolution, or otherwise known as Revolution 1.
But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright. You say you got a real solution. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all do what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait. All right, all right, all right. Oh. change your head. You tell me it's the institution. Well, you know, you better free your mind instead. But if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't gonna make it with anyone anyhow.
Such an awesome song. Now, one way that song sort of hits home with me, my older brother loved that song as well. And that wasn't his style. It wouldn't be the style of pretty much anyone in our family other than me, probably. But he loved that song, and I absolutely loved it. So just interesting, the piano on that, I'm not sure. I've looked through the credits, and I've never really looked and seen that. That wasn't Billy Preston. He was not. He still hadn't played with them at that point, correct?
I don't think he did, and so I'm not sure who that might have been. You know, they overdubbed, so it could actually be McCartney playing the keys on that,
right.
or possibly George Martin.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to counter that with something off of Sgt. Pepper. It's not my favorite song, maybe, off Sgt. Pepper, although it's right up there. Interesting. My daughter's middle school choir teacher had his own little band and did a song that sounded much like it. So when he did that, I was able to pick out right away, oh my God, he's paying tribute to Getting Better. And I asked him that one time, is that what you were going for? And he goes, absolutely. Good call. You know, so I love this song. It's Getting Better from Sgt. Pepper.
Getting better, it's getting better. Since you've been mine, getting so much better all the time.
Okay, so I'm pretty sure, and I ain't even bringing this up. This is in a sense, I feel so cheap even mentioning this. There was a movie made in, I don't know, what was it, like 1978 or so, or 79, called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It wasn't the Beatles. It was, it featured George
the Bee Gees
Burns.
Mainly.
Yeah, George Burns as the narrator. And I am pretty sure, this is scary, I'm pretty sure that he actually, for the movie, sang that it was George Burns sort of like talking, if you will, for that song, For Getting Better. So, yeah. I mean, I hate that I'm even bringing this up because it's so terrible.
It wasn't the William Shatner version, although I don't know if he actually did this.
But I just... It just
he did Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, I believe.
Yeah, he did. He butchered it, of course. But but you know, it just the fact that they made a movie like that, and I mean, it's a great tribute and all that stuff. You know, imitation is a serious form of flattery. But holy,
right.
I mean, to butcher a song like that, I'm sorry, that should have been, you know. But that song, I just love that. It's just a I don't want to say right. I mean, it's just a good, tight, hard guitar part, but there's no super, you know, solo, no shredding or anything like that. It's just, but just a good straight ahead, hard guitar. And, I mean, that album really is the first, I guess, I wouldn't say the first concept album. They'd already done a couple that you could have called that, but that album was the ultimate concept album. And as I said, I think at one point that was the most frequent topic of, masters and PhD theses in music schools in the United States from like 1970 to 1980, something like that. And I forgot where I read it or what exactly, but I mean, it was, you know, that album is still debated by, you know, I mean,
well,
not just
as a turning point, you know, in rock music, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
where I think the statement was, Where it stopped becoming sort of ritual. I would argue though that Revolver is and Rubber Soul were fantastic albums, but
absolutely.
One analyst said, you know, there was a docudrama that was on the Beatles that was based on. I don't know if you're familiar with the author named Philip Norman wrote a book about the Beatles called Shout.
Okay,
came out
about
a year after Lennon was killed, early '80s. It's a very good book.
Yeah.
Anyway, he talked about how it was stopped becoming ritual dance music and became music that people that you would listen to, you know, sort of like other genres like jazz or classical or something.
Well, speaking of jazz, I'm gonna go out of order on this because your third choice, I think, is decidedly jazz influenced. I would even say that a lot of the album that it's on is jazz influenced. That's I Want You / She's So Heavy. It's a longer song, and that's why I want to kind of get it out. Not get out of the way. I just want to make sure we get it in because I just think it's an incredible song off of Abbey Road.
Yeah,
and then we'll
the
get
front
back
side
to
of Abbey Road, first side.
Yeah, the front side. And you know, you always hear we'll play. I've recorded, folks, just for who want to know, I do have these most of side two of Abbey Road ready to go for, you know, the back part of the show. But this on the first side was just, I don't want to say groundbreaking, but think of it as Blood, Sweat, and Tears or Chicago without horns. And that they accomplished that sound, in a sense, without using horns. I mean, this is I Want You, / She's So Heavy, from Abbey Road. I love that ending. I know it sounds crazy, but the way that song ends, just now listen to, now, you know, I asked about Billy Preston. He did play on that song. He played the organ on there.
Yeah.
McCartney's bass playing certainly can't, and Ringo's drumming certainly cannot be left out, because both fantastic. I always got, you know, you always hear people say Ringo wasn't the best, you know, Ringo, like Charlie Watts, you know, was not the show drummer, not the, you know, the big show, but to sit there and say wasn't an effective or a good drummer is just absolutely crazy if you're listening to that. But McCartney's bass playing to me is just flat out amazing. But listen to who worked on that album in addition to the Fab Four and George Martin. Billy Preston, as I said, Phil and Ian McDonald, who have done more production, you know, arguably as much as anyone over there. Jeff Emmerich, and then here's another name that might jump out, Alan Parsons. Alan Parsons. It's an Alan Parsons project, who also, by the way, was the engineer on Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. So, you know, to say that that little thought went to that would be crazy. I mean, they obviously.
I don't think there's any way. Yeah, I don't think there's any way you can talk about, especially the later Beatles era and great guitar work without including this song.
Oh, absolutely. But again,
it's great, and it's the most, to me. And you know, you're more of an aficionado on this, so I'd like to hear your thoughts. It's the most Jeff Beck-esque type.
I hear that
they ever did, and I wonder though. If did Beck ever do a version of this on any of his albums?
I don't know. He did a version of A Day in the Life, of course. But Beck's first big solo albums after, you know, he'd gone out on his own, he'd sort of joined in with other you know, guys. He was with Rod Stewart for a while, sang with him, and Ron Wood, believe it or not, from the Stones. But you know, his two of Beck's more famous albums that sort of brought him back into the discussion of great guitar were Blow by Blow and Wired, both of which were produced by George Martin. I mean, I think it's no mistake that George Martin knew how to play to a musician's strength. I think it's no accident that, you know, he brought in, you know, like Max Middleton and, you know, some session jazz players as well. In the production of that, and brought in orchestration on Blow by Blow, especially, you know, I mean, I think that's, you know, pretty clear where the influence was there. And that's why, you know, you're right. It sounds very, when I'm hearing it, it's like, yeah, it's not a shock that Jeff Beck went the direction that he did on Blow by Blow with George Martin on production. I mean, that's no accident, definitely no accident. So, I mean, it just, that song, you know, as you said, it has the most jazz tone to it. Just the quality, the total quality of the guitar alone is just like, you know, you can just feel it. You can almost get a, you know, a really good instrumentalist. You know, because vocals, it's, you know, when you add vocals, it's a different story. But a really good instrumentalist, you can almost visualize them in the studio playing. You know, and that's what you can do there. I mean, you can clearly in your mind, if you can't. That I urge you to sit down and take a weekend and listen to Abbey Road over and over until you do see it. Because everything, I mean, take the song Something, which, you know, sounds, oh, just a nice little ballad. But really, Frank Sinatra used to cover it in concert.
Yeah, the slide guitar on that, too.
Yeah, Frank Sinatra covered that in concert, you know. And you can joke and say, oh, you know, unfortunately, things like Joe Piscopo's parody, which was hilarious. But unfortunately, stuff like that sometimes gets people out of the mindset of what an incredible musician and vocalist Frank Sinatra was. Well, he, you know, took something and covered it for years. You know, that's, again, no accident. I mean, genius, you know, likes hanging out with genius.
Yeah.
You know, it's simple
exactly,
as that.
Yeah.
So for my next offering, I'm going back to the White Album, a.k.a. The Beatles. And this is more up your original song, your first choice. I'm not going to say it out loud because I don't want to. I want to like surprise. But unfortunately, this song also has, of course, some terrible connotations on the backside. But here we go.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. Till I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah. Do you?
A great close. I got blisters on my fingers. That song has it all. It has fade in, fade out, or a fade out, fade back in, fade out again, fade back in again. Of course, the connotation being that it supposedly was a huge influence on Charles Manson, who, of course, died, a couple years ago. But, you know, look at all the stereotypes it blows off. One, Dil Rock, yes. Were they playing guitar like maniacs? Yes. The drumming? Yes. You know, and then here's the biggest thing. Because when you hear Paul McCartney, I mean, if you talk to somebody now, somebody born after 1990, and ask them, you know, what kind of, you know, Paul McCartney? I mean, first of all, their first question is, wasn't he the guy with wings? But they're probably also thinking, oh, he sings love ballads. Paul McCartney sings little ballads, you know, Paul McCartney, or he does songs with Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson. You know, he's listen to the vocal on that. I mean, he's just absolutely screeching almost. I mean, it's just, I get the connotation.
Good stuff. Yeah, it really is.
I get the connotation.
Weird, wild
that it was,
stuff
that it's evil.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I get the evil connotation and all that, but, you know, you can't blame somebody. You know, it's sort of like, you know, when we talk about guns, you know, guns don't kill people. You know, people do. And Paul McCartney,
well, I mean,
and
there's,
John
there's
Lennon,
something,
you know,
specific in that song that would lead to the Tate LoBianca murders. But, you know, people like that, they take their inspiration from all sorts of, you know, weird stuff. I mean, is The Catcher in the Rye really something that you could say would inspire someone to go and assassinate John Lennon? I don't know, but it did for Mark David Chapman, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Now, that, of course, that album, and we're going to play your next selection from it, that album had all kind. I mean, they play, because they're in the studio, they played extra stuff. McCartney plays drums on a couple of songs, including Back in the USSR, Dear Prudence, one of your other songs. Lennon as well offers up some drums. Harrison, you know, across the board, basically just you know, adding bass and stuff like
and,
that. He
and also,
also,
you know, who appeared for the first time, and maybe the only time, because I don't know if he's on any other albums, on the White Album, several tracks, especially the one I think we're going to do next of mine.
Yeah, right.
Is Eric Clapton.
Yeah, and although people will say, well, why didn't George play lead on that? George did play organ on that, which was kind of is interesting. You know, the history of Clapton and George Harrison, of course, doesn't end with the White Album. They remained friends, although there was the issue. Eric Clapton, I guess, sort of, you'd say, stealing Patty Harrison, writing Layla about her and all that stuff. But, you know, be that as it may. This next song, I know a lot of people love what Prince, when they had that one, there was one jam session and Prince comes out and plays on it. And people will say, oh, it's the best performance. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how you beat an original. But this is also from the White Album, While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And again, it's not just the guitar on this. There's a lot more to it. So here we go.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's sort of cheating because you really took a Clapton riff there, a Clapton solo of you know, when we're paying tribute
playing
to
the lead on this, I think.
Yeah, well, we're paying tribute to great guitarists that are no longer here, but Clapton's still here. But technically, you know, we've talked about others. So,
but it's a Harrison composition, though.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair then. So that we may not get your last song, mainly because we're of our time, because of what we're going to play last. But this next one is one that used to scare the crap out of me. It's one I grew up near train tracks, so the train sounded near the end of this song. But I also knew that the field near those train tracks, I was always told that there are ghosts out there and scary people and all that. So when I would hear this song at night, and then hear the train whistle, I would freak out. But it's a great song. This is Strawberry Fields Forever. It actually came off the Magical Mystery Tour soundtrack, not off the actual album, but the album's the movie soundtrack. Here goes.
Let me take you down. Strawberry fields forever.
just love that song. It still scares me a little bit at the end.
Great stuff.
That little coda fade out and then fade back in. Like I said, that used to scare the crap out of me, though. I don't know why. It's not that scary now, but it's conjures
well,
up that image. So,
you know, that's famous because if you listen right at the end there, he's saying this fueled a lot of the Paul's dead
right.
stuff, you know,
yeah.
that he died in a car accident. Because it says, I buried Paul. It says John,
right.
basically. And so they use that. That's you know, evidence that McCartney did die, and it was a double. You know, the Paul McCartney that we've seen since 1966 is not Paul McCartney.
Right.
It's absurd, but you know, there are people that bought into that. You know, it's sort of like the Elvis is still alive stuff. You know, kind
right.
of, but.
So think about this. That was not on an original album because it had been released as a single, and their record company had a policy of not putting previously released singles on albums. It was originally released
right.
as a double A side with Penny Lane. Think about it. You think about some of their songs and what they were, you know, that when they released them as singles, what they backed them with. I mean, that backed with Penny Lane, that's damn near epic. I mean, you just don't get that.
Paperback
kind of.
Rider and Rain that came out the year before
yeah.
that, part of the Revolver sessions, but not on the Revolver album.
Right. And of course, the famous Day Tripper and We Can Work It Out is the most famous. So. But now we're going to get to our – since it's 16 minutes long, we are going to get to what I consider the highlight of their stuff. Now, is it the very best? Maybe not. But I think you can't argue that it's certainly a highlight, if not the highlight, of their release, of their work. This is, of course, from the Side 2 Abbey Road medley. I'm beginning it with You Never Give Me Your Money.
Okay.
You only give Lullaby. Go get back home. Sleep pretty darling, do not cry. And I will sing a lullaby.
So I cut off Her Majesty, which is included on that, but I cut it off there. Okay, so it's a total of 8 songs. 6 of them are under 2 minutes. 6 of them were listed on that Breakfast with the Beatles of their shortest releases. It's the only song that features a Ringo drum solo, believe it or not, in their whole catalog. It features all 3 guitarists when I include Paul McCartney, in addition to his incredible bass on Sun King. But they all 3 have solos on the end. They're on the end. I'm not sure what more you can say. They call it, within the group, they call it the long one. Others call it the medley. It's simply incredible, and I had to include it. You know, in this show. But we are coming up on a hard end. But still, I couldn't play that. I just couldn't. I don't know how we could. You know, it's just. It's simply just incredible. You know, next week we're going to play.
Out, you know,
yeah.
there's a poignancy to it, because you have to understand, Abbey Road was really the last album they did. Let It Be came out after that, but it was recorded before that.
Correct.
So really the last sort of spasm that the Beatles had was when they came together to make Abbey Road, and this is what they were doing when they broke up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, who knows what else was there, you know, what was still there. I mean, it's just incredible. Before we go, I do want to thank Duck Northwest Media, Joseph Gibson, and Andy Hawk for dropping in. Of course, Mike, Hawkeye Mike, helping me out here, and Sue from New Mexico listening in on the phones, as my big sister was earlier, and my uncle-in-law. Next week, we're going to come back, and we're going to finish this part of it with the tributes to the individual work of George Harrison and John Lennon. And, Mike, you might be surprised at my assessment of all of it. I can't wait to hear yours, of course. But hopefully we can be back.
Well, there was a lot of good stuff.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I'll say it right now. I'll preface it with this. I think stuff that George Harrison did was the most relevant of any of the individual work of the Beatles, post-Beatles. That's just my assessment, but we will discuss it next week. In the meantime, folks, have a great rest of the week. Have a great weekend. Be safe. And have a good month of May. Mike, we will talk to you next week.
Okay, thanks, Hank.
Thanks all. Have a good night.